The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Two hindrances, sensual desire and ill will. I like to think of there's a narrow technical meaning, and then there's a broader, more practical meaning. And so when you read the suttas, the teaching of the Buddha, that's the technical meaning, so it's kind of a narrower. But the narrow meaning sometimes is too narrow to really, or the wider meaning is more useful for us. So with sensual desire, the first hindrance, it's specifically sensual desire is the hindrance. But there are people who find that there's all kinds of desires besides sensual desires which become an obstacle for their concentration, for their meditation, for their presence. And so it's more useful to just label it desire in general, hindering desire. So the narrow meaning for the second hindrance is ill will. And then some people find that so narrow because there seems to be things they don't have ill will about, but they have aversion towards. And so again, you have to kind of be willing to kind of flow or be gracious about the narrow, the broad meaning, the way these words are used. And so rather than being caught up in the words so much, always with Dharma teaching, I think what's useful is to not necessarily try to fit yourself into the teaching, but rather try to fit the teaching into your life. So how does this work for me? How does that happen for me? So I'm not sure exactly what they mean here, but for what I do understand, how can this be helpful in my life? Make some sense? So these words, it's kind of, you know, it can be difficult. Now, the Buddha in the suttas, when he gave a kind of the best place, kind of that's a definition of this ill will, it's one has a mind of ill will as follows. So when one this, may these beings be slain and slaughtered. May they be cut off, perish, and be annihilated. So that's a pretty strong and narrow definition of ill will. It's very clear. But again, there has hostility in it. And so this quality of hostility is, or wanting to something to be, you know, to cause harm, is with a narrow definition. The broader definition is to just really want to get rid of something. You don't necessarily want to harm it or, but you want to push it away, you want to get away from it. Very strong, kind of caught up in the world of getting away or pushing it away or something. So there's this range, right? Now, there are consequences of the hindrances. So they affect us in certain kinds of ways. And here, there's a kind of a little bit, a classic description of how it affects us in relationship to meditation practice. So when we're caught up in desire, desire tends to have the quality, not always, but tends to have the quality of bringing us into our thoughts, thinking about things, and it tends to fragment us, tend to be disassociated from ourselves a little bit. We're so caught up in the desire that we want, we're not really here connected to ourselves. And that, and in meditation, we were supposed to be connected. We're supposed to be here and present. So the hindrance then interferes with that connectedness part of meditation practice. Ill will, the second hindrance, tends to create a hard mind or a tight mind or a constricted mind. And that clearly goes counter to the function of meditation that creates a soft, relaxed, open mind, expanded mind. Sloth and torpor goes against or counters the idea that we're supposed to see clearly what's here. You have clear seeing. And when you're filled with the kind of torpor, you can't see very clearly. when you're restless, you can't get settled. You're restless, you can't be settled and concentrated or focused on what's happening. And but more so, when you're restless, you can't be. What they say is you can't feel contented or happy. And then doubt. When there's a lot of doubt, there's vacillation. Mind is caught up again in thoughts, and inability to be one-pointed or experienced. I'm just kind of settled. Just here I am. Just going to focus on this and not kind of go left and right and back off and all that. So, in that kind of explanation, they're offering how, for the purpose of meditation practice, the hindrances interfere with some of the development that we want to see happen in meditation practice. We want to have a mind, our ability to be settled and here in a soft, happy way. We want to have a soft mind, expansive mind. We want to see clearly. So these things kind of operate. I think for a long time I was aversive to the word hindrance, because I thought the word hindrance already had a judgmental quality to it. It's like, oh, there's this thing which is bad, and you're already setting up something as being bad, as being wrong, and it's already kind of creating a unfortunate kind of duality where it's, you know, you're critical of something and not other things. But I've relaxed that attitude over the years, and I think that rather I take the hindrances at the face value. They're what hinder, and I think it's important to recognize how things operate, and we recognize the effect that these hindrances have, and they have one effect is they hinder. Now, the second hindrance of ill will has a variety of effects on us. They hinder clear seeing, they hinder the mind being soft and open and expansive, they hinder compassion, they hinder a variety of things. They hinder, and that it's appropriate to want to overcome that hindering effect. And it doesn't have to be, we don't have to be aversive to aversion to know that, oh, this is useful to overcome this hindering quality. It's possible to have all these hindrances, perhaps, possible to have desire and an aversion without it being hindering. I've had anger arise inside of me, and I can see the anger arise. There's tremendous clarity. I'm centered. I'm expansive. I'm present, and I'm not going to be caught by the anger. The anger just floats up. It's like the mind is Velcro, Teflon mind. And so in that case, I wouldn't call the anger a hindrance. Because just anger, it's not hindering anything. And then there's been a few times in my life, I think, if I think about it, maybe, where I think, that anger arose and it was a hindrance, I got caught by it. And in that case, it's a hindrance. So this kind of thinking helps me free myself from what I used to think was this kind of judgmental attitude towards, this is a bad part, impure part, or defiled part, and that whole language. There's part of me which is evil or bad. You're looking functionally, pragmatically at what's going on, and functionally, pragmatically, there's some things which are useful and some things which are not, and we need to understand how this operates. Also, there are things that are maybe useful to have aversion towards, to avert towards. But there's a difference between simultaneously there can be the healthy averting from it, wanting it to be different. It should be different. I would like it to be different. And at the same time, we're caught in the hostility towards it. We're caught in the compulsion to get rid of it or change it. And that can be confusing, because it's really easy to justify wanting to get rid of it. And in the justification, justify the hostility or justify the compulsivity that's there. We're not necessarily trying to get rid of the healthy wanting to change it. We're trying to free ourselves from the compulsive quality of that. That makes some sense? So I think with aversion, it's really helpful to kind of tease apart these things so we really get into understand what we're talking about. And then finally, I think that to repeat that for the Buddha, ill will seems to be part of this, some quality of ill will, wishing, as part of it. So, I think the effect that this hindrance, ill will, aversion, the negative effect that this can have on us, can be many, many faceted. It's many different ways that it affects us directly in the present moment, in our body, mind, and hearts, and many ways in which it affects our relationship to the world, what happens in the world spills over and all kinds of things. And I think it's useful to start getting some sense, some broader understanding of the cost of aversion, of ill will. I don't want to say there's no benefit ever. That we'll just bracket. That we'll just keep for another time. I think for now what I'd like to do is for us to look at the cost, the consequences, the negative consequences of what the experience of and the experience and the acting on aversion or ill will might be for us. So, what I have in mind is that you would divide up into groups of five, and then each person, I think for this kind of exercise, I think it's best each person is going to talk very briefly, like just maybe a couple of sentences. It doesn't have to be the full story of what it's about. But to answer this question, and then to keep going around in a relaxed way, just go around, everyone's kind of relaxed, and go around and around. And as you keep going around and around, when it's your turn, hopefully the whole group begins learning from each other, understanding each other, and begin kind of stretching and exploring this topic in a deeper, deeper way. It opens up in a way that, the whole group would, after a few rounds, would have said all the obvious things, and then now they're beginning to kind of discover new things and and trying out new ideas and kind of exploring it further. And so the topic, the question, is what are the unfortunate consequences of aversion, ill will? And I think it works best probably if you just kind of talk from your own life rather than the abstract of, what's the unfortunate consequences? And that can be at all kinds of levels. It could be, when I have that, I clenched my jaws, and I'm having to get retainers now. It could be that, my brother hasn't been willing to talk to me for 30 years because of, I lashed out once. So it can be a whole range, that's part of what we're trying to do is kind of flesh out all the different kind of things. So we start seeing the many, many different kind of ways in which aversion, ill will, the cost of aversion, ill will in our life. Make some sense? You understand the idea of kind of going around?
Yeah.
And going around, so we'll see how what happens as we... And so I thought it might be good to do it for about 15 minutes. It's a relatively long time for this, but I think that because it's so long, I hope that the group will kind of begin kind of opening up or discovering or intuiting something, new things will pop up, and hearing each other, the other four people in your group, will give you ideas and help you and see where it goes. You guys game? So let's see if we can have groups of five, and let's try that out first. And if there's some people left over, we can I can help them join another group. Well, it sounded very lively in here. It seemed like you were engaged, so I let it go longer than the 15 minutes I said it would be, because hopefully that was useful. And of course, I was not part of any of the conversations, so maybe it would be nice to hear a little bit what that was like for you, to do that and explore it that way, and how was it useful to have that conversation? How was it useful for you to have that conversation?
I forgot what I was going to say, so somebody else should go.
So, somebody else? How was it? Pass it down there.
But how was that for honesty? I don't remember what I wanted to say.
Well, one thing that really came out was how we all had shared experiences, and really shared. I mean, it was phenomenal. And the other thing that really came out is how this keeps us from really living, and how us kind of it keeps us kind of as a passenger in the car instead of driving the car and really engaging in life.
Great, thank you. Yes.
So it was great to notice in the moment just the stream of consciousness as we went from one person to another, and noticing within myself the irritation or the aversion or feeling emotionally flooded. And then as people kept going around the circle, how that would change. And then I would feel appreciation and for what people had said. So it was the changing nature of things.
Great. Great.
Yay, aversion can go away.
Okay. I don't know if this is actually answering your question. Is this on?
Yeah.
It's like when I look at the same question with sensual desire, it's helpful for me in terms of letting go of sensual desire, whereas with aversion, it doesn't work that way. There's some more power in aversion with me. So I'm really looking forward to when we start talking about ways that we're going to work with it.
So let me see if I understand. So looking at the consequence or the cost of aversion doesn't help for you.
It helps because I see the price, but it doesn't seem to help the power of it doesn't diminish like it does with sensual desire.
Okay, that's yours. Anybody have the opposite, or not the opposite, but the experience that actually having a clearer sense of the consequence, the cost of aversion helps you come back off or let go? Some of you have that? Yeah?
It's a
new idea, yeah. Yes, please. Is it to the mic?
I think what we found out as we did our group discussion was aversion is like hitting rock bottom. And what happened was we became aware of it, not philosophically or trying to figure it out, but I think we knew that we needed to pull out of it. And through the studies that each of us took through different pathways, it set a ground that if we hit bottom, there's only a way to go up. And that was the pleasant part of it. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm mental. And so I've had trouble discovering my ill will, or just, and as I mentioned in the group, at one point Bobby would tell me, "You're angry." I'd say, "I am not angry." And so anyway, the thing that I have found and trying to work with that over the years, like for instance, it came down to just, we were getting ready for a trip this was earlier than that. But anyway, finally, Bobby and I had a spat, and I just stormed out and said, to hell with it, I'm not even going to talk to you anymore right now. And I stormed off upstairs and so on. Finally, it's taken me now about 2 minutes to really be unhappy with that feeling and knowing that our relationship is at risk. What in the heck is she going to, how are we going to deal with this, you know? I just know it really is a mess. And so now I think it took me about 2 minutes to come down and said, I don't like what's happening. I don't like what I did. And let's do something about it, you know. But just to say, I don't like it. It's not good. There's the cost right there. But a lot of that is anticipating what the cost in the relationship is.
Great.
In the future. And then seeing, okay, now I have a choice. Do I want to live with this? Do I want to live with that? No. I'm going to go down and do that. And if I have to eat crow, fine, I'll eat crow.
Great, great. So there's something very, can be something very healthy about not liking aversion, preferring it not to be there. Now, but there's another possibility, and that is having aversion to aversion. Or having hostility to hostility. And that is a recipe for problems. Isn't that?
So when you say aversion to aversion, isn't that, what is the difference of that and intolerance to suffering, which is a good thing?
Yeah. And so I could have a splinter in my foot.
Yeah.
And that's suffering. And I could want to take it out. I could be saying, I'm not going to tolerate this. This is not good. I'm going to be intolerant towards it, and I'm going to take it out, do something about it. That's fine. One can also be have a splinter in one's foot and hate all splinters. Hate the fact that we have it. Hate the world for making splinters. You know, and caught up in this fury and anger and aversion and hostility towards the feet and the splinters and the wood and the trees. And so there's a big difference. So person can have aversion and say, this is not healthy. I need to work with this. I need to understand it better. I need to kind of free myself of it. That's fine. But to have aversion to aversion might be, I hate myself for having this. I hate having the aversion. You know, there's all kinds of kind of unfortunate secondary things, ways in which can be resolved from that. But to have aversion around aversion is to contract around the aversion in some... Guilt in Buddhist terminology, guilt would be a form of an unhealthy reaction.
So
if you have guilt towards aversion, it's kind of an aversion towards aversion.
So it leads to more suffering. Then.
Leads to more suffering. To have remorse over aversion, that's maybe considered healthy, but to have guilt is not. So Kim, Sue.
I was caught in the aversion and hindrance. It's that it's totally taking me away from what it is now. That was I had a great experience. It was even actually at that moment I was unconscious and I didn't. Just I wasn't me, and I wasn't aware of anything. What's happening? And now, and so I lost the benefit of being there in a whole thing, myself and or other people involved in that party, because I could have contributed, you know, joy. And then it was all gone. It's just so negative, negative result came out of the aversion. And then I even did not recognize in an hour or two. And then after I take it out of that situation and the party, and when I come home, I realize, wow, what happened? I wasn't there.
Yeah. It's the way in which being caught in aversion disconnects us. What's happening? So one of the teachings in Buddhism is that all the hindrances, they interfere with our ability to see what is really true, what is really happening. And so there's ignorance operating with the hindrances. We're ignorant of the true nature of what's happening. And so if the hindrances are taken over, then there's also an element of ignorance or not understanding of what's happening as well. And so it's interesting that with aversion or ill will, it's sometimes said that we focus on the unpleasant aspect of experience. That's where we're fixated on it. Remember that's what the unpleasant experience, the unpleasant aspect of what is going on, that's the catalyst for the aversion. And so there's a strong tendency then, when there's a strong aversion, to only see the unpleasant side of things. And so it's a biased view. It doesn't see things as they really are because it only sees half of it, maybe the unpleasant side of it. And so sometimes the antidote to aversion is to see the pleasant side of something or the beautiful side. So you see some person and you have aversion to a person, means you have aversion to some unpleasant aspects of that person or unpleasant projections in that person, so unpleasant there. So an antidote is to expand the view of the person, see the person more fully, more broadly, who the person is, by intentionally looking, what's beautiful, what's pleasant, what's nice about this person as well. It doesn't deny the fact that maybe the person's doing something unpleasant, but it's only a partial view. And so we want to, oh, yes?
That's great. It reminds me of one.
Please, yeah. Give Victor one of his mics back.
Mine. It's great. It reminds me of the notion like when you have desire, you don't see the faults or the negative aspects, and
exactly.
The corollary, when you're in aversion, you don't see the lighter, the better parts.
Yes, perfect. And so now in that, in this context now, you'll have maybe a better understanding of a Buddhist practice which can seem very strange. The Buddhist practice is the practice of noticing the unpleasant or the unbeautiful aspects of reality. And there's a whole meditation practice of focusing on the foul or the unpleasant or the, you know. So what are these Buddhists doing? They're so negative and looking at the unpleasant, and what's this about? But when a person is caught in desire, they only see the pleasant aspect of it. And if you want to see the full range of what's really going on, we want to also notice the unpleasant. And then we see it's more fully what it is, and then we can take more careful responsibility of what we want. But then people say, wait a minute, you know, that doesn't seem right. They said it should be good enough, you know, I have this beautiful experience, it's so nice right now. Why can't I just stay there? Why are these Buddhists such a party pooper? And but in this context, you see that we're caught by desire. In that situation, this is an antidote, and it allows us to see the bigger picture. And it's very similar to the aversion, where we look there with the aversive mind states, we looked for the pleasant, or the beautiful. When we're caught in desire, we looked for the unbeautiful. So that's interesting, yeah.
One of the awarenesses I had was to realize, I think even more with aversion than with attachment, a strengthening of a sense of the ego and self, that I really become empowered with aversion, that I, you know, sort of like that woman said before, I'm going to change the world and I'm a, you know, done age. And so it really, as I reformulated it, detracts from any gains I may have made in practice.
Yeah. So it also then interesting to look at aversion and look at the benefits that come from it, or the assumed benefits, or how we get charged by it, charged up. And so one of the benefits, from one point of view, is that it builds up a sense of self. And it's because of that benefit that some people latch onto it. In the bigger picture, it's not beneficial to do that. But in the smaller picture, it's, wow, I feel good, I feel up, I'm pumped up. Some people like aversion because it gives them energy. And so they feel energized, you know, great. Some people like it because they feel justified. If I can be critical and resentful to someone, it means they're wrong and I'm right. And so it kind of start way of feeling good about oneself is to have that aversion. So one another so-called benefit is it focuses the attention away from ourselves. So we don't have to take responsibility. They're the problem. That's the problem. So I'm going to push that away or chase that away. So there are ways in which it's pleasant or enjoyable to, or you know, there's a hooks for aversion. So you understand that point? So I would like to do, before lunch, one more exercise. Are you guys up for this? One more? Or maybe about 10 or 12 minutes of this? So for this one, I would like you to pair up. And this is the what's called the repeating question. So repeating question is one person, you alternate, but the first, one person is the questioner, asks the question, the responder responds. When the responder is finished, the first person says thank you, and asks the same question again. And it goes on and on and on like that. And if you're the responder, you're not, it's different than a normal conversation. Because the point of this discussion is not to explain something to the person who asked the question. So it's really for you to explore something new on your own. So if you find yourself telling the person a story, something, that you know all too well the picture, you've said this 20 times before, you know the whole thing, you're wasting your time. It's not for the sake of the person who's asking the question you're responding. It's for your own sake to explore something. So if you find yourself telling a story, get to the punchline quickly. The person doesn't need to know the full story. Make sense? So you can kind of come to the edge of your understanding and you begin exploring things anew. So the question is, and I'll give you the question and I'll give you some variations just in your mind, kind of opens it up a little bit. What is the hook? What hooks you onto anger? What hooks you onto anger? So what that means, what is it that seduces you? What is it about anger, to aversion? What is it that hooks you to aversion? So what is it that is a trigger, or what is it that is attractive, or what is it that that grabs you? What is the authority that makes you think, oh, this is important, I'm supposed to be aversive here? What is it that's a hook? What's the belief? Is there a belief? Is there a feeling? Is there, you know, what is it that provides the hook? So, for example, it might be that I look up and see our coat racks are basically completely full of coats out there, and I have aversion suddenly, and to that event, that situation. So, what's the hook? The hook for me in that situation might be, oh, we just designed coat racks, and we didn't make enough, and we didn't make enough, and this means that Gil has poor interior design capacity, and you're all going to see that, and you're all going to judge me, and so it's a whole inner world gets caught up in, and therefore because of that belief about this all really reflects back on me. I see that with some aversion. I don't at all. I just made it completely up. No, I just grabbed the first thing that I could think of. See, I looked this off.
That's really the clean line of the room.
What? yeah, it's wonderful. I like the colors of the pattern of the colors of the jackets. And it's so beautiful and so glad to have it there. So what is a hook? What hooks you onto aversion? And as you keep answering that question, perhaps a whole new ideas, new possibilities, new things will come up for you as you keep answering that. Yes?
Do you think it's more productive to, each time you answer the question, to think of a different situation? Or do you think it's more helpful to keep going back to the same situation and delving deeper?
I think it's helpful that each time that you finish and the person says thank you, both of you clear your minds. And then the person asks the question, it's like the first time you ever heard it. And it might, you might pick up the same thing again, or it might be completely, radically different. But just each time is fresh, kind of the idea. Okay, so why don't you pair up with someone, and if we're an odd number, then want the odd person. come here. So before breaking for lunch, can we have a little bit of reports or a little bit some comments about that from someone?
It's really hard.
It's really hard.
I didn't really want to go that deep.
Didn't want to go that deep. So you felt that question... So that question was kind of touched something that was tender or difficult for you. It's understandable.
I kind of enjoyed this because it helped me to realize why, you know, that I cannot stop my anger. You know, it's very, very helpful. And in the end, I realize only if I can understand all of this cause, that it really makes sense that in the end, I probably will not get angry anymore because it really doesn't make sense. None of that make any sense to me. Why I have to get angry?
Thank you. Diana.
I had a big aha moment, actually, that I realized that if I assign a label to things, desirable, undesirable, then I stop seeing things as they really are and stop seeing like their impermanent nature. And instead, I'm just seeing the label. So labeling things helps me kind of create the illusion of stability, solidity, constancy, which doesn't really exist, but sometimes I'm always trying to create, you know, the things that are solid. So my aversion, attaching a label and desirable, helps me to do that. So
great. The label is the hook. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I thought it was a very good therapy session. And I wish I could do this with my husband.
Uh-oh.
But I know the storytelling would start in and it would go for hours. It would be quite a miserable experience, a very different experience. But I had a very interesting, it had an interesting effect that I realized after the session was over. And that is, that it made it impersonal.
Mm. So you can talk about things that are, in a sense, very, very deep and personal, but it freed you up from the personal.
Yes, and that there was such a strong trend, listening to everybody going through the same thing, that it just, you know, it just made it very matter of fact.
Beautiful. Thank you. Now, just as a kind of footnote, the way that I think this was designed, this technique of repeating questions in its kind of original form, was you do it for 15 minutes. And we did it about 7 or 8 minutes. So 15 minutes maybe allows for going further and further and deeper, that because the first 5 minutes you're kind of saying often the common things. But having 15 minutes is long enough to get into the deeper stuff. So someone else? Yeah. Is the wireless on? You can't hear? It's on. Okay.
Somewhat in line with that, as I kept going through the layers and layer upon the question, the initial question started with, or the initial hook was feeling disrespected, feeling invalidated, not being loved. I agree with the therapy session thing. I felt like I was deep diving. And then I hit a space of, this is so primal, so fight or flight almost reactivity, that is almost part of the just human nature, that when we feel attacked or disrespected or invalidated, the shields that go up that prevent the actual interconnectedness that you could experience, it's so separated, and there is so much ready. And it goes from the most intense situation to the simplest, which mine is always when people cut in front of me in a line. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the simplest. You know, but then the various deepest layers with the husband and the children and that. So it was very interesting, because when I got to the primal, I realized, oh my God, this is such a common denominator.
Great. Thank you. Yes?
Bonnie. I'll try to speak out.
No.
Yeah.
It's on? I'd like to. We were pardoned. And I'd say the other side of it. I feel just tears came right up to the edge at the end, because you spoke so so clearly about the process, but it, and primal, you said, and it was being primal that we spoke that we're like, that we are animal and just this tiny bit of consciousness up here, and it was just quite overwhelming to both of us. And my voice is still shaking, but it was a beautiful thing to realize what we are as humans, and that we can have that much insight and that much openness to.
Great.
Thank you.
Yes.
I think the hook is self-love. But, you know, then the time stops, so I did not dwell deeper.
So you went, as far as you went, was to the self-love.
Right.
Uh-huh. Great.
Yeah.
So that'd be interesting to explore further, mm-hmm. what that means for you and different aspects of self-love. And
right.
Great, beautiful. Right behind you.
I found it really interesting to contrast doing the first session where we saw so many costs and consequences of aversion. And after that, I thought, well, certainly why would I ever want to have aversion? But in this session, I discovered for myself, rather than go deeply into one area, I kind of did a survey. There were a lot of attractions, in a way, to aversion, some of which you mentioned, which is feeling very energized and feeling like my life has a lot of excitement or drama. Feeling righteous and potent, and it will be interesting to look into each one of these more deeply, because the costs are not worth that. But there's a lot that hooks me in and pulls me in.
Great, thank you. So one more here, and then we'll stop.
One of the things that has hooked me is the seduction of a shared version. It really bonds you to people, you know, and that's been one of the more difficult things to work with.
Yes. Yeah. It feels good to gripe together. So, I hope that one of the pleasant aspects of the day is having lunch. So let's take do lunch, and we'll do an hour for lunch. And if you want to have lunch silently, a good place to go. You can go sit outside. We have new benches around. You know, you can sit, or the conference room. You can eat in the conference room if you want quiet. That can be the quiet place. But I encourage you also to. This is a great opportunity to get to know people in the community and other practitioners and people interested in the same thing, and continue with some of the conversations. And we can set up some tables inside, and you can sit around the table or sit on the benches outside. And so we'll start again in here at 1:30. Thank you.